Welcome to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms. There's a ton going on in real estate, and we have proof in the way of lots of news articles. It's an edition of Clues in the News, what the headlines are saying and what that means to you as a real estate investor. Today on the Real Estate Guys radio program.
Hi, this is Patrick Donahoe, CEO of Paradigm Life. Wall Street and banks spend billions of dollars per year in advertising with the goal to convince you that they are the solution. But take a look around. None of their advice has worked. If you're listening to this, odds are pretty good that you're already a real estate investor, or at least becoming one. So why do you do it? Is it to hedge inflation, the tax benefits, or maybe it's to get your money away from Wall Street? It's because of these benefits and so many more that I created the Real Estate Investor's Guide to the Perpetual Wealth Strategy. When you combine successful real estate investing with the Perpetual Wealth Strategy, you have the recipe for what has helped the wealthy to establish their financial well-being for decades. You can download the Real Estate Investor's Guide to the Perpetual Wealth Strategy today by clicking the Resources tab on the Real Estate Guys Radio homepage. Don't wait, go download it now.
Welcome to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms. With me, as usual, sidekick and financial strategist, co-host Russell Gray.
Hey, Robert.
How are you, sir?
I'm tired of being kicked, actually, inside, but well, it's all right. It's part of being a co-host.
Well, I thought just to be different, I'd sit across from you today, so that way I can kick you in the shins.
Thank you.
We are in the beautiful metropolis of Bozeman, Montana.
Yes, we are. It's a beautiful part of the world, at least this time of year.
It sure is. Oh, my gosh. I haven't been to Montana, the great state of Montana, for many years, and we're just outside of Yellowstone, and really, really awesome. Came here for the Red Pill Expo with G. Edward Griffin, our good friend, who is an amazing, amazing man, and just really had our mind blown this week.
Yeah, it's almost hard to explain, but sometimes people wonder, why do you go to all these off-the-wall conferences? And the reason is to get a 360. Somebody shared this with me once, and it really helped me understand something. Imagine yourself sitting in your kitchen, your kitchen window looking out the street, and your neighbor who's across the street is looking out their window across the street. And then there's a car accident right in front of your two houses. And on the one side, on the neighbor's side, somebody gets out and they stand up and they look at the front of their car and they call on their cell phone and they appear to be fine. But on your side, you see the door fling open, a child fall out, hit their head on the ground, and there's blood everywhere. So your neighbor has no concept that there's an emergency. It just looks like a routine fender bender. The person got out, they're fine. The person who was in the accident, who got out on the cell phone, has no idea. They're looking at their car. They're concerned about themselves first. And they don't realize that there's a child injured, maybe dying on the other side, out of their field of view. Somebody shared that with me once in terms of helping me understand how important it is to look at other perspectives and to hear other points of view. Of course, Robert Kiyosaki talks all the time about the importance of standing on the edge of the coin. There's not two sides to an issue. There's three. There's the perspective that takes into account both sides. Well, the red pill has got some fairly controversial subject matters, but there was a time when a guy like Peter Schiff was out there telling everybody that the mortgage crisis was coming and the housing crisis was coming, and people discounted him as a fringe character, as a perma-bear, as somebody whose viewpoint wasn't valid. We had people coming and telling us to be more cautious. And we talked about being cautious, but in actual practice, we were pedal to the metal and we were pushing hard. And of course, what happened is the economy ran into a brick wall as far as real estate went. And, it's no secret, we got hit pretty hard by that. So coming out of that, we said, we need to get around other people that are looking at things, and even things that don't seem like they're center mass to our particular areas of interest. And really, for me, that's what this was all about. And it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And just great to hang out with some awesome folks like Robert Kiyosaki, who was here. In fact, today on Real Estate Trivia, we've got an autographed Robert Kiyosaki book for you. Since we saw Robert again, we had him sign a book for our winner. So there's reason to stay tuned to Clues in the News. In fact, our first news story comes from Bozeman, Montana. This was in the paper the day we got here. Commissioners tackle vacation rentals. The Bozeman commissioners will continue a discussion about potential rules for Airbnb style short-term rentals in a special meeting. It goes on to say that after the last meeting, after hours of public comment, largely opposed to the stricter measures, the commission is deciding to do the second meeting, and they're looking at putting in more safeguards and regulations about Airbnb. Now, next week on The Real Estate Guys, we're going to have a great show on some of the disruptions happening in the real estate world. So pay attention to that. And Airbnb is certainly one of them. But this is a small town, about 50,000 people in this town. And yet a lot of folks, including our Real Estate Guys listener, who was on our summit a few years ago, lives here in Montana, came to the event. We got to rekindle a little bit. He's got several people staying at his home because he's got a big home with a lot of bedrooms that he does Airbnb. There's a guy concerned about this very issue.
Well, yeah. I mean, there you go. So, you know, Red Pill was about things like property rights. And property rights, you know, should you as a property owner have the right to rent out your room to consenting adults? You've got a property. Somebody says, I'd like to sleep in your bedroom. And you say, that's fine. And I'll charge you X. And you agree. The question from a political point of view, not to get political, but this is, you know, you're talking about a municipality, a city making a decision about whether or not they're going to permit this activity to go on. That's a property rights issue. Why is it going on? Well, this is a hospitality town. People come here on tourism. Well, when you're in a hospitality town, what's a big part of the industry? Hotels.
Yeah.
Well, who's threatened by Airbnb? Hotels. I mean, this is reminiscent of taxi cabs fighting about, you know, trying to prevent Uber from coming into their towns. And Airbnb has been had trouble in New York and other places like that for the same reason. So as a real estate investor, and Airbnb is one of the most profitable segments, you can buy a property and you can buy, you know, an A-class property and make it cash flow using Airbnb if you buy the right property strategically and really treat it like a business.
We got a bunch of students and listeners that are doing that very thing. Short-term vacation rentals makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So if that's your business model and you just go in without considering the political environment you're going into, you end up with a large capital investment based on a business model. And then you find out that your marketing plan or your revenue plan for that particular property is not going to be able to work because you're running into this type of resistance. To me, you know, we could talk about the politics of it. It is what it is. But the pragmatic part of being an investor is just to be aware of some of the resistance to what your business model. I'll give you another example. A friend of ours, Gene Guarino, teaches his residential assisted living facility program. And we're big fans of that. And this is where you go in and you take a single family home like a McMansion and you break the bedrooms up in such a way that people can live there for their long-term 24/7 assisted care. And it creates a huge amount of cash flow. Well, you know, zoning, the way it works right now, it just allows people to do that. Apparently, from what I understand from Gene, and I'm certainly not the expert, but I have taken the class, is that when you go in to set one of these things up, they really can't restrict you because it's already built into the zoning that you can do this type of business. Okay, I'm going to take that at face value. But it doesn't mean that you're not going to meet resistance. So, for example, a friend of mine was bought a home to do this, and they're living in the home for a little while until they do the conversion. And they were out at some social gathering, meet the neighbors, and she inadvertently opened up her mouth and said, hey, this is what we're planning to do. All of a sudden, she was a pariah. Everybody turned on her. Nobody likes her. They don't want anything to do with her. Not in our neighborhood.
Wow.
Don't do that. So it's not just being aware of the political environment, which is sometimes driven by industry, in this case, the hotel industry, because I think, Robert, what you said in this article in Montana is that the public who spoke up said, hey, we want this. We want to get in on the action. We want to get in on the hospitality business. We see the hotels making money. We want to get in on that too. And yet the city council is going, you know, let's go back and revisit that. Why? Because they probably got some, you know, what you'd call small town lobbyists, the hotel industry kind of, you know, and I'm not saying that's happened. I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I mean, let's face it. A person that owns a home has a voice. A person that owns a 180 room hotel who does that kind of volume of taxes, of income to the city and related businesses, restaurants and gasoline and rental car and all that. I mean, that is a constituency. And so it's interesting that maybe 10 people showed up who have Airbnb that said, we don't want regulation, but then 10 hotel owners who are doing 100 or 1,000 times as much volume of business.
Maybe saying, even employing some of those people that are resisting.
Bingo. So that's the thing about politics is there's always two sides of it. As real estate investors, you can choose to be political on your own. But the idea is we have to know what's happening in an area. It's why we're so big on tenant-landlord law and what is it like in a jurisdiction. Anytime I meet somebody from a place that I've never been and they're a homeowner that's renting a house, I always ask about tenant-landlord law. What's the tenant-landlord law like here? Is it tenant-friendly? Is it landlord friendly? Part of my personal investment philosophy is I like to invest in properties where the law is landlord friendly, not tenant friendly.
Right, absolutely. And these are all part of your due diligence checklist when you're going into a marketplace. You know, we get enamored of the property, we get enamored of the price, we put together our pro forma business plan, and all we see is sunshine. And the lesson is that whenever you go out, you always plan for sunshine, you hope for sunshine, but it's good to pack an umbrella. And that just means, you know, checking the weather report and thinking about, you know, what could happen and making sure that you're prepared for that.
All right. So there's our local article here in Bozeman, Montana. Bigger picture, a lot to talk about today. I don't know if we'll get to all of it, but we've just heard the U.S. median sales price of homes for May. We're here in June, so we don't know the result for June yet. But for last month, May 2017, $252,800, which is up from last month and up from a year ago. In fact, it's up 3.18% from last month and 5.8% from a year ago. Housing prices across the board continue to go up. This is, of course, from the National Association of Realtors.
Well, so I have a different article here that is kind of interesting, and it is referring to the Harvard's annual State of the Nation's Housing Report. And it says that the home prices in the 10 most expensive metro areas have risen 63% since 2000, while home prices in the 10 cheapest areas have gained just 3.6%. And so here's the thing. Real estate's local. You hear a stat like that, and you say, this is what the national average is. And yet within in that, there's great variations. And it goes back to, again, understanding the market, understanding the price point, understanding the demographics. It tells you overall kind of what the national temperature is. But you really can't, that's not investable. That just tells you that overall, as far as housing goes, it seems to be doing reasonably well or reasonably steady. And now you have to dig deeper and say, where can I find, you know, the outperformers, if you will, of the average?
Oh, absolutely. And not even on a national level, even if you hear your town. So let's say that they say that San Francisco prices are such and such. Well, San Francisco is too big of an area to make any kind of a decision on. You have to look in the neighborhood, right? Not just in the area, but you start with the macro and move towards the micro. And this is not just a U.S. phenomenon. An article out of the Journal in Ireland says, with the average house costing now 338,000 euros, the market is looking sillier with each passing minute. And the story says, when reading the history of financial crises, an uncomfortable feeling of deja vu arises. It's like the horror movie scene when the expendable character decides to split off from the group and descends down the steps into a dark cellar alone. You want to shout, don't go down there. You already know what'll happen. Well, we're seeing the same thing, not only here in the U.S., but in Ireland. Big overheated market. The article goes on to say, in Ireland, the average house costs 9 times the annual salary.
Wow.
That's expensive. Now, another article that came from MarketWatch says, as home prices climb, here's what buyers need to remember. So given this foundation that we see pricing up in a lot of places, this is an article that says, hey, we've seen this movie before, kind of like the article in Ireland. This says that if it seems like home prices are back to trending even higher, that's because they are. The median home price we just gave you, $252,800 in May, is a record. And that's naturally prompting many people to wonder if this is housing bubble 2.0. Well, now, who knows? A journalist, and this is something we always have to keep in mind, a journalist has to put out 1,000 words by deadline. So they're going to find out what's happening via these reports, via conferences, via talking heads, and then they're going to come up with their perception of it, right? And that's the whole thing about journalism. We spend a lot of time here in Bozeman talking about mainstream news and fake news.
And very fake news.
And saw some incredible examples of that. But if I'm a reporter, I'm going to go out and go, wow, median home price is up. And then I'm as the reporter, may interpret that data. And that's the thing I know you're big on.
Well, I mean, yeah, because the news isn't the answer. It isn't even the data. It's really the question. And so you read the headline and you have to ask yourself, first of all, is this true? Is this valid? If it is true, does it relate to me? And then you dig deeper. It's like, where did this information come from? Why are they saying it? What does it mean? And I love to use the news as a starting point to have a conversation like we are. And we do that all the time. And then the other thing, going back to what we said at the top of the show in terms of different perspectives and counterpoints, I'm looking back at the same article I'm referring to, and it says, well, nominal prices, meaning the number, just the absolute dollar price, may have returned to their pre-recession levels. When you adjust for inflation, real prices are still 16% below past peaks.
Yeah.
So, you know, somebody else could come and use the data, use this article to make the argument, hey, this horse still has a ways to run. Okay. maybe that's true. Maybe the market's overheated. And this comes back to the bigger conversation is you really don't know what the future lies. You're reading the news for clues and you're trying to figure out what the trend is, but you have to be prepared for both. And so when you're doing your strategic investing, the question is, okay, if the market is doing well and on the rise, then this is how I invest. If the market begins to pull back, then what do I do if all of a sudden the market begins to pull back? I don't want to be the last guy to figure it out. I want to be ahead of the curve. Better to be early than late. You know, people criticize Peter because he's always sounding the warning bell when he sees things wrong. But his rebuttal, and it's a good one, which is I'd rather be early than late. You want me to tell you the day after the stock market crashes?
Right.
I mean, it doesn't do you any good, right? So, you know, as much as you want to ride it all the way up to the peak, to the apex, sometimes it's a good idea when you suspect that a market is getting overheated to take some chips off the table. The good news is you can do that today because if you have real equity, and let me make a distinction, if you have real equity, which is equity that has gone up because incomes have gone up, and we're talking now specifically about income property, or even if you're looking in a geography where prices have gone up and you check the average earnings of the area, if you look at your tenant demographic and you find out that when you bought the property, let's say an apartment building, that your average tenant is paying you, say, 28% of their income. And then you wake up one day and you see that your tenant mix is paying you 35% of their income. Okay, you may have been able to raise rents, but their income didn't go up, and that's a party that will end. And you're making yourself more vulnerable to a softer economy because if their income begins to pull back a little bit, they're going to have to move to a more affordable place. And so it's just understanding the math. Now, if the income has been going up, then you have real equity and you pledge that real income to go access that real equity, cash out, refinance, and you take that equity out of that market. And you maybe go put it someplace else or protect it or whatever.
Now, we're going to do a show in a few weeks that's exactly that, given the fact that we are at a high and things might be going up and there might be a point where they stop and there's all kinds of interesting opinions out there on the horizon. How do you take some of these strategies that we're talking about here? But back to your point, this is clues in the news, not facts from the news.
Yeah.
Right? It's not, well, this is going to happen.
Not investing advice from the news.
No, it's not. And in this article, again, this is, and many real estate articles you're going to read anywhere have to do with homes that people live in. That's the biggest type of properties that we have. And so that's not the same as investment property, but we can glean these clues. This is back to that. Is the question, are we at housing bubble 2.0? And the article says, probably not. Despite the new record for prices, they aren't likely to fall in the spectacular fashion as we saw starting in 2007. The consensus forecast is that real estate prices will likely grow over the next several years at a 1% to 4% annual rate, thanks mostly to healthy labor markets, low mortgage rates, and tight inventories of available homes for sale. Okay, what we just read is an opinion from a journalist.
It is, and I would have issues with some of those conclusions.
Now again, this is CBS Market Watch. That's pretty mainstream news. This is not a housing economist saying this. This is a reporter.
Yeah.
A reporter who had to meet deadline and says, hey, and they're drawing conclusions, but still point on the curve. Now, what the article does go on to say, and this you will like, is that buyers would be well served to avoid the mistakes so many Americans made during last decade's housing price bubble. And here are a few of the lessons. So the article goes on to say, start with researching, looking at exactly what we're talking about. What are the price trends? What are rent trends? What's happening in terms of net migration? All those things.
Income that, trends.
Income, for sure. And what about things like regulation? The article in Bozeman, are there things like that you need to be aware about? And they go on to say, you'll want to know what the home price to income ratio is in your local market. So this example is, if the median home price is 240 and the median income is 80,000, then the ratio is 3, which is reasonable. Now, we just heard in Ireland that homes are selling at 9 times annual salaries.
Right.
That's probably not reasonable.
No, I mean, that's the whole point. And what happens is it flips over from being fundamentally priced to technically priced. In other words, it's momentum. So when you have people who are getting in just because it's going up and they don't want to get left behind, they overspend believing it's a good investment. And a lot of people look at their homes as investments and they chase the market. And it's always dangerous when you're chasing a market. You still have to maintain your discipline and look at the fundamentals. housing equity, housing prices, any price of anything really should be driven by income. And so if you're not doing an income analysis on anything you're buying and you're just buying off price momentum, you could be buying into the crest of a wave and it could turn over. And here's the other thing too, because it's one thing this thing doesn't take into consideration. There are a lot of homes owned by hedge funds right now. Now, it isn't the majority. So, you know, the flip side of that is there's still a lot available. But see, the thing is through comparative sampling, which is the way that these prices get established, one house in a 1 mile radius can affect the price of hundreds and thousands of houses in that 1 mile radius.
Yep.
And so if these guys were to decide, hey, I think the market's at a top, they could be wrong and you could disagree, but it doesn't matter what you think. If they believe it and they dump their portfolio, that's inventory that hits the market. They're cashing out and they're going to go chase and ride whatever the next wave is. And that could put downward pressure on your pricing. Now, if you're smart and you get your equity off the table, then they dump the price and the price goes down and you jump in and buy more because you've got a sale going on. That's a different discussion. But there are dynamics active in the marketplace that sometimes people who don't see the whole picture because they're journalists and they're covering a lot of different things and they're really not in the space, they're going to miss. And you, as an astute investor, need to pay a little bit deeper attention, which is why we do shows like this.
Absolutely. But happy to see that they're at least putting some prudence out there to say, hey, consider things like your total debt to income ratio and calculate your expenses and make sure you're figuring all those things out. So good tips there. It's Clues of the News today, articles that we found from around the globe and what they mean to us as real estate investors. More when we come back. I'm your host, Robert Helms.
Need help with your real estate investment portfolio? Check out the resources page at realestateguysradio.com.
This portion of the Real Estate Guys Radio program is brought to you by International Coffee Farms, where you can own a parcel of land in your very own specialty coffee farm in Panama for as little as $15,000. Here's how it works. Deeded half-acre parcels entitled Specialty Coffee Farms in Boquete, Panama are turnkey managed professionally on your behalf by a team of local experts. Sustainable average income is estimated at 12%, and cash flow can begin within 12 to 15 months from the date of your parcel ownership. International Coffee Farms' mission is to own and operate specialty coffee farms that are economically, environmentally, and socially sustainable. As part of this mission, 20% of the gross profits of each farm is committed to a socially sustainable fund to improve the lives of the Panamanian coffee farm workers and their families. International Coffee Farms currently owns and operates 9 specialty coffee farms with half-acre parcels available for immediate ownership. To find out how you can become a coffee farm owner in Boquete, Panama, email coffee@realestateguysradio.com. That's coffee@realestateguysradio.com. Forbes rated Memphis the best cash flow market in the nation. And our good friend Terry Kerr at Mid-South Homebuyers has been the premier turnkey rental property provider in Memphis for over 13 years. With an A-plus rating from the Better Business Bureau, Terry has renovated over 750 houses. Real Estate Guys listeners have snapped up hundreds. Discover what these satisfied investors already know. Mid-South's properties are completely renovated with a 1-year warranty and a lifelong rental guarantee. They're affordable, well-managed, and easy to own. Perfect for beginning investors and veterans alike. Get in on the action. Contact Terry and his team via email at midsouth@realestateguysradio.com.
Hi, this is Chris Martinson, author of Prosper, and you are listening to The Real Estate Guys.
Welcome back to The Real Estate Guys radio program. Thanks for tuning into the program. If you've ever wanted to do bigger deals using other people's money, come on out to The Secrets of Successful Syndication. It happens in September in Dallas, Texas. All the details on our website at realestateguysradio.com. Every couple of months, we peruse the headlines. Well, actually, we kind of do it every day, especially
every day
for us. And then every couple of months, we do a show on clues in the news. What are the headlines saying? And there's a couple reasons for that. One, as we've talked about, your perspective as a real estate investor, what does it mean to you? But the other thing is to know what the rest of the folks out there are reading and talking about. So that's like we like to look at the mainstream news because that's what most people are reading. And then we like to look at alternative news because there's interesting things there. This is an article that is kind of an article. It's from the source here is Pulsonomics, and it's the cost of renting versus buying in the U.S. So as long as I've been in real estate, a long, long time, one of the things we've always talked about is the rent versus buy analysis.
Right.
And this varies by area. Some areas where the prices are high, it can make better sense to rent. Some areas where there's more affordability, like one of the big city for home affordability in the last 20 years, and we talked to Aaron Adams about this a few weeks ago, is Indianapolis.
Yeah.
For many, many years, that was the most affordable city in the U.S. to buy a home. And so no matter how much money you made, as long as you were creditworthy, you could probably buy a house there. So what does that mean to you as a landlord? might not make sense to be a landlord in a place where your tenant can easily buy a house. Now, today, Indianapolis is a great market as a landlord, but things change. This is really interesting to me because this is from June, and it says, historically, follow me on this, the percentage of income needed to afford the median rent, historically, 25.8%. So the median rent out there means you that the percentage of your income, 25.8% of your income is what you would need to afford at the median income rate to afford the median rent. Okay, well, a lot of people probably have that. And historically, this is over the last 20 years, the percentage of income needed to afford a median home, 21%. All right, well, check it out. This is today. Now, the amount of money, percentage of income needed to afford median rent, 29.2%. The percentage of income needed to afford a median home, 15.8%.
Wow.
This is the biggest disparity we've seen, and it means that today, for many, many people, buying a home makes better economic sense than renting.
Yeah, and you know, we say all the time, do the math, and the math will tell you what to do. So, of course, this is, you know, an analysis you're going to be doing if you're going to be in single-family homes in a marketplace, and you're trying to figure out if there's going to be a good demand, or you're going to be losing tenants because they figure out pretty quickly they could buy a house for less than it costs them to rent. The flip side of that is when you go into a marketplace where you can't really have that make sense, then the challenge is it's hard to be a landlord because now you're paying a lot of money for the house and you can't get in enough rent yourself.
Right.
So you have decisions to make in your personal residence and, of course, decisions to make as an investor. But I think, again, the lesson, and this is reiterating something that's kind of been a theme that's emerged as we've done the show, is the importance of doing the income to price analysis and following the trends because they're moving. And especially if you're in, you've got multiple units in a marketplace, you want to be sure that you're kind of analyzing your own tenant base and you know what you've got going on and where they're at and how affordable your housing is for your tenants. Because your tenants, if they can't afford it, are going to move. If they can afford it, you might be able to push it even a little bit, regardless of what's going on in the market. So pay attention to your numbers.
Well, of course, there's a big underlying premise here, and that is that you're creditworthy. Many, many tenants are tenants because they either don't have down payment and haven't been able to save it up, and so it doesn't matter what percentage of their income is, or their credit isn't such that they can get a loan.
Well, you know, that's interesting because as a landlord, you know what your tenant's credit is because you pull it. And so you know, you say, well, I don't want to have somebody with bad credit. Well, maybe you do.
Right.
Maybe you do. Because if you work with your mortgage person and they tell you, hey, somebody can buy a home pretty easily if they've got 680 or above. And so if FICO you say, score. Oh, well, I want to make sure I have a 680 FICO for all my tenants. Well, maybe you don't,
right.
Because then they could easily move out. Maybe you want to say, hey, I'm going to be the guy that takes people if, as long as they have a good story, because mortgage companies don't care about the story. They just put the number in a box and either it says yes or no, and that's it. Thumbs up, thumbs down. But if you're willing to hear a story and somebody comes waltzing in with a 580, they're probably going to have a harder time buying a home.
Yep.
They're probably going to need to stay renting from you longer. And if other tenants have stricter credit underwriting and they aren't willing to listen to the story, you could have a competitive advantage. It's the same thing as when you're willing to accept pets. People say, oh, I don't want to have any pets. Well, when you do have pets, then you end up providing a competitive advantage. The guy with the pet knows it's harder for him to find a home. And so if you take him, he's going to stay longer. He's going to be less trouble because he doesn't want to lose the gig. Yes, you probably can have a little bit more damage in your property, but it's all baked into the cake. You just got to do the math because it costs you a lot to turn a property, pet or no pet. And if
right.
the guy stays longer, you might spend 30% more, you know, on the turn, but you might do half or one quarter as many turns. And so your net dollars ahead when you do a five-year analysis, let's say.
Well, the other thing about it is depends on your exit strategy. If you're just holding it for the production of income forever and let the tenants' payments pay your mortgage off, great. But what if part of your exit strategy is, I might find a great tenant that wants to be the buyer of this house one day? Well, then that's a different strategy. Someone who maybe they have the credit profile, they have the income, they just don't have the down payment. So in many places, you can do what's called a lease option. And there's the opportunity for someone to lease your property with an option to buy. That's not legal everywhere, not every country, not even every state in the U.S. But in many places, you can do that. And so again, it's this idea that I want to make sure I have a tenant that has income durability, but I also want to make sure they're not going to skip as soon as they can go buy a house from the builder across the freeway that's offering a, you know, some sort of builder carry back.
Well, yeah, I mean, their income durability is only good if they are in your property. They could have great income durability, but if they move out, their income durability isn't durable to you. They left.
Absolutely. It's Clues of the News. Today, we're talking about articles that are affecting us as real estate investors. In fact, another article we'll have when we come back is about mortgage rates going up and what's happening to credit, speaking of credit. We'll also play real estate trivia next. You're tuned to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helms.
Live nationwide, you're listening to the Real Estate Guys. Find out more at realestateguysradio.com.
Ranked by Forbes as one of the fastest growing cities, Orlando, Florida has a big and diverse economy, yet still features affordable rental properties that cash flow. Our boots-on-the-ground turnkey provider, Greg Bond, at Greater Orlando Homebuyers, can show you how to start generating cash flow today. He just wrote a special report to help you discover the magical market of Orlando. Request your free copy today. Send an email to orlando@realestateguysradio.com. That's orlando@realestateguysradio.com.
Are you ready to profit in paradise? Hi, it's Robert Helms, and if you think real estate investing means tenants, toilets, and termites, think again. Located just a short plane ride from the U.S., a virtually untouched paradise awaits, the beautiful country of Belize. When you go to Belize with the Real Estate Guys, you'll spend four fabulous days discovering one of the most intriguing real estate markets I've ever seen. With its jungle rainforests, pristine beaches, and 81-degree turquoise water, Belize is one of the most beautiful places on Earth. Plus, it's considered one of the top seven tax havens in the world. Belize property is on the rise, and many experts think the best is yet to come. But don't just take my word for it. Come experience Belize firsthand at our upcoming investor field trip. When you join us, you'll discover the many reasons we love Belize, like tremendously undervalued beachfront land, super low taxes, ease of doing business, and so much more. Get the details at realestateguysradio.com. Just click on events. See paradise for yourself. Click events at realestateguysradio.com, and I'll see you in beautiful Belize.
Hi, this is Anthony Melchiori from Hotel Impossible, and you're listening to The Real Estate Guys.
Welcome back to The Real Estate Guys radio program, broadcasting this week from beautiful Bozeman, Montana. Thanks for tuning into the show. It's Clues in the News. We've got a few more articles to bring your way. Before we get back to that, it's time to play real estate trivia. This is your chance to win a prize by knowing today's real estate trivia question. And because we just hung out with Robert Kiyosaki for a couple of days, we've got an autographed copy of his book, Second Chance. That could be yours if you know today's real estate trivia question. When you hear the question and think you know the answer, send your best guess to trivia@realestateguysradio.com and include your name and your mailing address, plus the answer to the question, so that we can send you off this big old thick book with Robert's signature in it. Last week on The Real Estate Guys, we had Damian Lupo on the show, and we were talking about unleashing the real power of your retirement account, and we asked this: a Roth IRA is named for Senator William Roth. In which state? Was he a senator? Well, the answer is William Roth was a senator from Delaware from January 1st, 1971 until January 3rd, 2001. The Roth was established by the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997. Here's our real estate trivia question for this week. Since we're in beautiful Montana, we want to know, what is Montana's nickname? You know, states in the U.S. have different nicknames. What is the nickname for the beautiful state of Montana? If you know, or maybe just want to take a guess, you can send off your guess to trivia@realestateguysradio.com. Pretty easy question for a pretty cool prize.
Easy, yeah.
And the prize is a copy of Second Chance from Robert Kiyosaki, signed by the man. That is today's real estate trivia question. It's Clues in the News, and we're looking at articles that affect us as real estate investors. We're just talking about the importance of understanding credit from a tenant perspective, or obviously when you buy real estate. Here's an article that came out from Better Dwelling. It says, as mortgage rates go up in the U.S., credit rates are going down. This is an article that came out June 24th, and it says mortgage lenders are seeing a long-term trend of declining credit scores in the U.S., and real estate analysis firm CoreLogic, that's the source of the data, observed that an increase in mortgage rates is resulting in a slip of credit scores. Interesting stuff. In fact, specifically they say that since 2009, for every 0.5 percentage point increase in mortgage rates, the average credit score on a refinance has dipped by 9 points. And he believes this pattern will likely continue if mortgage rates move higher. So let's step back for a minute. We always want to understand where mortgage rates are because they affect us as landlords and what we pay. They affect the places our tenants could go. If you're in a property and you've got a fixed interest rate and you know what your costs are and mortgage rates go up, that prohibits your tenant or makes it more difficult for them to, if they had the credit and the down payment, to go move. So that could be a good thing. unless, of course, you're planning to acquire more real estate, in which case you don't want interest rates to go up. At the end of the day, we don't have any control over interest rates, but they definitely affect us.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm not exactly sure. There can be correlation. Two things can occur at the same time, and there can be causality, meaning one thing caused the other.
Yep.
I don't know that I understand what a causality would be in that. That doesn't make sense to me. You know, I would have to speculate that maybe it's flushing people out who are a little bit on the margin, who, you know, are coming into the market feeling like if they don't get a loan now, they may not be able to get one because rates are starting to rise. Sometimes when rates start to go up, that happens.
I don't think they're actually trying to draw a causality here. It does say that when a significant percentage of income goes towards servicing debt, it can become more difficult to make payments, not only on the house, but on other things, right?
Yeah.
So affordability in general, back to that idea that a certain percentage of my income can go towards my housing expenses, whether that's renting or owning, as a bigger percentage of my income has to go towards my housing expense, there's less affordability for other things.
So, you know, one of the warning signs when the credit markets begin to get desperate, because credit markets depend on expansion. If credit markets aren't expanding, it's a problem. I could go into all the reasons why, but just trust me, we have to constantly add more debt to our economy. It's just the nature of the system. So we have all this talk and jabbering about getting out of debt. It just can't happen. The debt has to move, but it always has to expand. If we really did have debt contraction, we would have economic contraction. So with that said, a couple of different ways that lenders, especially in the mortgage space, make it easier for people to borrow, which is everybody's motivation that runs the system, is they're going to lower the barrier to entry from a credit standpoint, and or they're going to lower the barrier to the entry from the debt to income ratio standpoint. I'm going to say that I think it's a whole lot more important to pay attention to the debt to income ratio. When you start seeing lenders willing to let someone borrow up to 50, 55% of their gross income and dedicate that to a house payment, you know that you are in a big problem, right? The normal rate should be somewhere between 28 to maybe 35, and in an aggressive market, maybe up to 40. You start getting in the 40s and the high 40s, and that's what's going on. There's just nothing left, because in an environment where rates are starting to creep up, you don't get the benefit of a decreased rate to relieve the payment. And then when you start seeing things like teaser rates and these step-up loans coming back into the marketplace, or where people just begin to ignore income altogether because now they're just 100% betting on the property appreciating and the protective equity, now you know you're staring a bubble in the face. So these are the things right now, going back to these earlier articles about how prices and asking the question, are we in a bubble? The way you know if you're in a bubble is by looking at the income ratios. If the income ratios start getting out of whack, then and that tells you that you're staring at a bubble. So pay attention to that in your portfolio and in the marketplaces you're investing in.
Absolutely. All right, let's look at another segment of the market, and that's retail. And you might say, well, I'm not a retail investor. Well, certainly people do invest in retail and strip malls and syndications that go by big shopping centers and so forth. But even more so, think about your tenants and where they work. Right. So the couple things we're going to talk about that are going to make sense for you to understand.
I went to a bachelor party once and invested in a strip mall.
Did you? Okay. Mm-hmm. Wow. A lot of investment there. Hey, this comes from Bloomberg Technology. It says, as retail outlook dims, mall tenants push for shorter leases. So there's a couple of things within here. So just let's take that at face value, saying that the retail outlook is dimming. Okay, well, there's a lot of reasons for that. And we'll talk about store closures and some things. But let's just assume that for now, that, okay, for all the reasons we know, people are buying on Amazon instead of bricks and mortar, that retail is not the greatest place to be. Well, tenants of malls are now pushing for shorter renewals and shorter leases. So when you're a retail tenant, and again, keep in mind, most of our listeners probably don't invest in retail, but this is an area we know fairly well, being on both sides of this. So we have a business that is that leases a retail space, and we have a lot of retail spaces that we lease. So we're on both sides of this. So the idea is, when I'm putting my business somewhere, it's the same decision I make as a homeowner. Do I want a longer lease because I want to make sure that the kids can be in the same school district, or I'm unsure of my job? I know when I moved to a new town, I decided to rent a house for a year. Even though I hate to rent, I didn't know the area well enough. I didn't know the neighborhood. I didn't know the nuances. I made the best decision I could as far as school district and those kinds of things, but I wasn't confident enough to shell out big bucks for a house just yet. Today, I own the very house I rented, so that's a different story. But as a retail tenant, I'm making the same decision for my business. I'm expecting to open a business and have success. But as we know, most businesses fail. So we're right now in the middle of this as a retail tenant with a business that we own, and it's time to renew our lease. Do we want a nice long lease? Do we want a shorter lease? Well, the trade-off is this. If I ask for a longer lease, then my landlord has to decide what they think the future 5 or 10 or 20 years is going to look like, because we're going to negotiate a rate and probably some escalations. And I'm going to be held to that. So say I decide I want a 10-year lease, and every year the rent's going to go up by 2%. Well, that might sound reasonable. But 8 years from now, when the rent's now gone up 2% and 2% and 2%, it might be that the market is way less than that. And I'm in a very expensive lease for the time. So I have to make those kinds of decisions. So this article is saying that retail tenants are choosing, when possible, for shorter leases.
Well, and I think the bigger thing is it's kind of a sea change. And I think that's the point of the article. You know, any business is always going to have to decide, do I want to do a short-term or a long-term lease? And that's not something that has changed because the environment has changed. That's always there. Any individual business is going to have to ask that question. Any individual business is going to have to go in and look at a tenant mix and say, you know, because what you're doing is you're buying a neighborhood. Most of us can relate to neighborhoods. If I'm, you know, going to go out and buy a house in a neighborhood and I see the neighborhood pretty stable, and I say, I can see myself raising my children here, living here for the next couple of decades or whatever, then I go ahead and buy the property. I get the 30-year loan. I hunker down. I settle in. I do all my little fix-ups. I make those capital investments, and I've got my home, and I feel like this is my neighborhood. I get to know the neighbors. I get mentally, socially, emotionally invested in addition to my financial investment. Well, if I go into a neighborhood, I'm not quite sure where the neighborhood's going to be in 5 years, then I don't go as deep. Does that make sense? And so if you're a business and you're seeing these anchor tenants, because remember, when you're a retail, a big part of your advertising budget is in your rent, because you're paying for a location.
Yep.
You're either paying to co-locate near other people so you can lever off of their marketing, or you can capture some of the traffic. You know, it's a reason car dealerships, you think, why would the Nissan dealer co-locate right next door to the Toyota dealer? That seems silly. They're competitors. Yes, that's true. But when someone goes to shop for a car, they don't always go looking for a brand. They go looking for a car.
Yeah.
And what you hope is that somebody says, oh, well, I'm going to go over there and look at the Toyota, and then I'm going to wander across the street and look at the Nissan. And so you want to capture the person who's there. So this is the concept in retail. This is the way they think. Well, if you're looking at malls like Sears, that have been anchored by Sears or Penny's or these big reliable traffic drivers that have big ad budgets or used to, and these things are dying, and you really don't know what the makeup or the vibe of the mall is going to be, are you going to make that longer term commitment? All other things being equal, you know, the uncertainty of your business and blah, blah, blah. But just, I think the article is saying that the face of retail is changing because of these major anchor tenants are going away. Now, if you're a strip mall operator or a major mall operator, you are really having to be creative, because it's no longer about the shopping, it's about the experience. And you have to create experiences in your mall that get people to come in. And shopping is almost a byproduct. People want to shop, they shop online. If they want to have an experience, they go to a mall.
Right. They want to go out shopping, and they want to have lunch, and they want to catch a movie. And those things aren't going away. The dry cleaner typically is not done over online, right? I'm not going to send off my dry, I'm sure that exists, but that most people don't do that. I'm not going to go to a restaurant online. Those are retail experiences that are still doing mostly very well. And in fact, some retail is really rocking, but again, fundamental shifts. This article came out June 9th. It references an article that came out in April, just a quick headline here on Bloomberg. America's retailers are closing stores faster than ever. In fact, they say that Amazon is gobbling up most of the industry's online growth, the shopping industry. So it's easy to buy online, but to your point, the experience. One other point in the curve on this talks about the shoppers staying home. And this is the sources, Cushman & Wakefield and Moody's Analytics. It says, with mall traffic remaining sluggish, stores are expected to close in record numbers. In fact, the biggest number of store closings, it's been pretty stable here for 2014, 2015, 2016. More than double expected in 2017, higher again in 2018. Those are store closures. So we've talked about the retail side. Let's talk about how that affects your residential property.
Yeah, exactly.
Because right? You've got people that work at these very stores that are closing. If I have people that live in my apartment that work at Sears, that could be trouble.
Well, so Sears just recently published a list of, I think, 20 or some odd stores that they're going to close. And, you know, we've said in the past that if you were to look at where these companies decide to open a store, it's usually the path of progress. They've done the due diligence. They've studied the demographic trends. They've looked at the infrastructure, city plans, all that kind of stuff. And they've decided, hey, I'm going to put a store here because the people are going to be there to support it. Well, you know, if you're on the other side of it now and you're looking at a portfolio of 1,100 stores and you choose to close 20, well, if the population was there, if the demographic was there, if the affluence was there, then you probably, if the store was not being managed well, you would transfer in a performing manager to solve the problem because the potential in the marketplace still existed. I obviously not inside the decision-making plans at JCPenney or Sears, but I would think that the stores that they're closing are probably stores that are located in places that are weak for the core drivers they need to drive their business. And so if you are having a tenant demographic that is very similar to their shopping demographic, then you can look at where they're closing their stores and ask yourself, oh, if I own properties there, maybe it's time for me to be closing out my portfolio there and be moving on to brighter pastures. So there's some lessons to be gleaned, what we call watching the big dogs and seeing what they do. You're not privy to why they do what they do. You have to infer that. But at least if you think it through and then begin trying to look for some of the supporting data yourself, you might find that what you suspect turns out to be corroborated by the data.
It's Clues in the News. What's going on out there in the world and what it means to you as a real estate investor? We'll have at least one more article when we come back. You're tuned to the Real Estate Guys radio program. I'm your host, Robert Helm.
Real estate investment advice right in your mailbox. Sign up for the free Real Estate Guys newsletter at realestateguysradio.com.
If you love real estate and have always wanted to own your own business, listen up. The Real Estate Guys and their panel of experts want to teach you how to go full-time fast in the real estate syndication business. These next few years may go down in history as one of the best times ever to acquire investment real estate. There are deals everywhere if you know where to look and how to assemble the resources. The Secrets of Successful Syndication Seminar will show you how to make big money doing big deals from a team of experts that have syndicated projects totaling more than $1 billion. Don't wait for someone to give you a raise or create a job for you. Attend the Secrets of Successful Syndication and learn how to build a team, raise capital, find deals, and make full-time money in 6 months or less. Go to realestateguysradio.com and click on events. All the big players use syndication as a way to diversify risk, optimize profits, and earn big money. You can too. Go to realestateguysradio.com and click on events.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high net worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years could be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. For more information, qualified accredited investors should email coconuts at realestateguysradio.com. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. Email coconuts at realestateguysradio.com. This announcement does not constitute either an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offering made by prospectus only. For more information, email coconuts at realestateguysradio.com.
Hi, this is Donald Trump, and you're listening to The Real Estate Guys.
Welcome back to The Real Estate Guys radio program. Thanks for tuning into the show today. Hey, if you haven't figured out what you want to be when you grow up, come on out to Create Your Future. Our goals retreat happens at the beginning of every year. The first weekend of the year, 2018, will be in beautiful Lake Las Vegas this time. At this point, you can save the date, and in a few weeks, we'll have all the details up on our website. It is time for Clues in the News. We're talking about lots of different articles, and we'll wrap up with this one that came out on June 11th, the Wall Street Journal. Help for home buyers burdened by student debt. So check this out. Fannie Mae and several states offer aid for young people who want to be homeowners, but they have student debt. So interesting article. It talks about that the debt people have from student loans make people less likely to buy a house, not only because of the affordability, but because they're looking at it going, well, I'm already in debt. I don't want to be in debt anymore. And so this is an interesting concept and backed by Fannie Mae to convert student loan debt to housing debt.
Yeah, there's a couple of different things to think about it. First of all, just on the macro, if you can't get people in on the front end of the funnel, then it doesn't push prices all the way through the funnel. So if you've got boomers and people out there who are going to eventually be a burden on Social Security and other areas, you've got to find a way to push up their housing prices. They have to be able to get out, which means you need to have people coming in on the front end. So that's one side of it. The other side of it is, from the government's perspective, you've got Sallie Mae, who has backed up a lot of these student loans, and they can't escape it through bankruptcy.
Right.
Which is, you know, they feel like, okay, we're going to get paid one way or another. That's good. The problem is students still are defaulting on it. And all it's doing is it's stopping them from really becoming more active in the economy because they don't have access to credit.
So here's what they're saying. The article says, this initiative from Fannie Mae helps borrowers who already own a home to convert their student debt into housing debt that carries a lower interest rate. Borrowers can refinance their mortgage through lenders that are backed by Fannie Mae to pull some equity out of their home to pay off the student loan. So the rate on the refinance is lower than what would be available, and certainly lower than their student debt, most likely. And it's in part because the buyers don't have to pay the additional fees that lenders usually charge for such so-called cash-out refinancing. All right, so when you refinance, you're going to pay fees, and this is a way to roll that together. It says anyone can take advantage of the program, even if they don't have a student loan, as long as they're using the money to pay down student debt. All right, well, if you don't have a student loan, I guess you still have student debt because you borrowed it from Aunt Myrtle or something.
Yeah.
It says, for example, a parent, grandparent, even a stranger could pull equity out of their home to pay down someone else's student loans. Okay. Grandma, let's have dinner. I got to talk about something.
I'm smelling a loophole, just be me.
What's interesting about this is, if you think about student debt, the other thing about it is, even though, yeah, you can't dismiss it through bankruptcy, and so they feel like Sally feels like she's going to get paid, she doesn't really have any collateral. As soon as you convert a student loan debt to part of a home debt, you now have collateral.
Yeah, this is a balance sheet adjustment that the federal government is doing. They're trying to move the liability from Sally to Fannie, basically. And so we'll see. I mean, you know, but at the end of the day, you just have to look at it as an individual and decide, does it make sense? And I think as an individual, it probably does. You're going to get tax deductible debt, lower interest rate. You're going to have the upside potential on the house. You're going to get a home, stability, all the things that are great. And if you really were to get into trouble, I don't know, because, you know, we haven't seen all the details, but we know you can't get out of student debt through bankruptcy. If you end up going bankrupt, you can get out of the housing debt through bankruptcy. So it's actually a little bit safer for you. So, and you know, the thing is, it's in everybody's interest to get young people involved in housing. So say what you want about the government being involved, but if they're going to be involved, it sounds like they're maybe trying to do something that makes a little bit of sense.
Well, this talks about the fact that when Fannie Mae polls lenders to see what are the challenges in making loans, that student debt comes up a lot. And this article is not just about the Fannie Mae program. It lists some others. And for example, in Maryland, the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development has what they call the Maryland Smart Buy program, which started last fall. And through this program, the state provides a second mortgage up to 15% of a home's purchase price in the form of a zero interest mortgage loan with no monthly payments to be put towards paying off the buyer's student debt. So now you're paying off your student debt with more debt on the house, but zero interest rate and no payments.
Yeah. Well, so here's the thing. You know, as a real estate investor now, we have to ask ourselves, well, where are these young people most likely to buy? And where would their participation in the market most likely benefit the neighborhoods? And maybe you can get in a little bit ahead of that curve. So again, this goes back to this notion of paying attention to the bigger picture, taking a look at the demographics and the economics underneath it. And if those student debt payments are going to start being converted into mortgage payments, and that money is going to start moving into a housing area, if you're in an area, a marketplace that you like for a lot of other reasons, and you add this one more mix, what product type, what neighborhoods would these young people who are taking advantage of this program most likely go to drive pricing, it could end up being very beneficial for you.
All right, there's our clues in the news from Big Sky Country. Next week on the show, we're going to talk about disruption in the real estate markets and all kinds of technologies and techniques people are using to change the face of real estate. That ought to be interesting. In the meantime, go out and make some equity happen.
This episode of the Real Estate Guys Radio Show is brought to you by Paradigm Life, powerful cash management strategies using life insurance. Learn more at beyourbank.com. Mid-South Home Buyers, low-cost, turnkey cash flow properties in Memphis, Tennessee. Corporate Direct, asset protection strategies for real estate investors from attorney and rich dad advisor Garrett Sutton. Find these and other great companies under the Resources tab at realestateguysradio.com. To learn how you can expose your product or service to the Real Estate Guys audience, call 888-489-7723, extension 4. That's 888-489-7723, extension 4. Or use the feedback page at realestateguysradio.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week right here on the Real Estate Guys Radio Show.